saçı tanan.
Saçı tanınan.
join with all.
So we are entering another phase of this afternoon, a long phase actually. It's going to be a 90-minute process, first a keynote and then a process that we are going to be led through. And I will introduce you two people now, out of which one is going to do the process and the other will come on later on stage through the conference. But the reason I would like to introduce both of them because they represent something. They represent organizing, keeping the torch of integrative movement in America, Diane Mushaw Hamilton and Terry Patton. So please give a big hand. Yay, you guys are here. A delight. So just a few words of introduction. First, I'd like to introduce Terry, because then Diane will do a long process for us. Terry Patton knows Ken Wilber for the early 70s, from the early ages, early days of Ken, which is the 70s, both personally and professionally. And Terry created the Bay Area Integral, which is the main integral hub in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's kind of regional within the U.S., and he also co-authored the book Integral Life Practice. So if you ever heard the term Integral Life Practice, it's Ken and Terry and some other co-authors. And also, he just recently published a new book, A New Republic of the Heart, and the subtitle you might tell us later. And this is a very significant book because Terry's integral heart is beating for ecology and the survival of humanity. And he has a very fresh look, probably an upgrade of Integral, published in his books. So if you want to see what's cutting edge and new in the Integral movement, I highly suggest to check out his book. So, Terry, do you want to say something to us?
Well, I want to invoke the missing third. Jeff Salzman should be here with me and I.
Hello,
let's
Jeff.
Have a moment for Jeff.
I hope you see us through online media.
And, things are far too serious, given what time it is on the planet, for us to lose our sense of humor. So it's a time for us to find new capacities to be both brokenhearted and open-hearted and joyous. And how we do that is what I hope I'll share with you later when I come on Sunday. But right now, I'm just delighted that I'm here with my favorite Zen master, my dear sister. So you have a treat in store for you now.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you so much. So you will hear Terry later. And about Diane, he is an award-winning mediator. He is the leader of the Integral Facilitator Training. And She's also lineage holder in the Zen, Soto Zen tradition. She's a direct student of Genpo Roshi. So she leads silent sitting meditations, like more traditional Zen. They actually just opened the Zen dojo in America, and also practicing Zen through a combination of Zen and voice dialogue, that's the big mind process that came through Genpo and Diane. So she's very skilled in facilitating not only small groups, but large groups. And today you have the fortune to have a facilitation from Diane. So
thank you very much, Vincent. I appreciate that. Hi, everybody. Hi. I know a lot of you. We're old friends. So I want to just begin by thanking Bense and thanking your entire IEC crew, because you've done a tremendous amount of work in bringing all of us together. And I want to give a shout out to Rebecca Colwell and my colleagues with 10 Directions and the integral facilitators who've been through that program that are around the room and going to be supporting you. And I'd also like to thank you, the audience, for coming, making the trip. How many of you actually traveled to get here? Take a look around. It must mean something. So I just want to appreciate you for making the trip, for being so open-minded, so open-hearted. And also, I want to appreciate you for listening to me in English. Because for so many of you, English is not your first language. It may not be your second. And so I have the privilege of speaking in my mother tongue, and I appreciate your willingness to listen. And what I hope to do is to speak slowly enough that I'm not too slangy. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what it means exactly, but we'll know it when it happens. So our inquiry is, we're going to look at evolving worldviews. We're going to look at the way our basic lenses of seeing and experiencing the world grow and expand, and with that expansion, become more complex, more complicated, depending, but also the spaciousness, the kind of competence that actually arises from our expansion. There's a competence that comes along with this complexity. And maybe most importantly is our capacity for care. That as we grow, as our identity shifts, as the way we see the world shifts, so does our heart and our willingness to be engaged from a different perspective. So before, there's a little square here that I feel a little pressure to stay in it, you know, so you'll watch me. So I want to give you a little bit of history, because just like you, there were a lot of kind of events that came to bringing me to this moment. And I was working in Salt Lake City in Utah as a mediator, and I worked for about 15 years before I was introduced to Integral and to Ken Wilber's work. And I was operating with some very naive assumptions. And some of you who've read my books will, I talk about this, but it's a very important turning moment for me, because I was imagining that as a mediator, I could, if I had enough good intention, and if I had a certain skill set, and the right set and setting, that anybody could negotiate an outcome and a durable agreement, and we could solve any problem. Right, it's a good idea, right? Yeah, why not? Yeah, evolving worldviews. So what I learned, and I just started to kind of notice it and experience it, was that there were people in my mediation sessions who couldn't take their own perspective. They couldn't really advocate for themselves. Maybe they were from an abusive relationship, and so they had kind of been beaten down. Maybe they were from a marginalized culture, you know, where they didn't have much voice, so they weren't used to speaking out. Maybe they had never really been asked, you know, what do I think and feel? So to expect them to be able to both advocate for themselves and share their perspective was just simply wrong. And so there were times where I really had to work with that experience of having someone who literally didn't know for sure what their point of view was about this problem. So that was eye-opening for me. Then there were lots of people like us who could take our own perspective, but when it came to really engaging and sustaining the perspective of another, it was always very shaky. And it wasn't that people couldn't hear it, but in terms of really being able to open to it and see the the true and partial perspective, that kind of didn't happen, right? And so you'd get no perspective, a perspective of self, and then you would find people that actually did, were able to listen to other people and take it in and experience it as real. And then you would have other people who could have no perspective, have their own perspective, have the perspective of the other. They would move to a third-person perspective and bring in what a court might do. They'd bring in what the facts and the law had to do with the problem. They could bring in an evaluation or an appraisal and use that information and not dispute it. So I just started to see, like, oh, this perspectives thing is actually like a real deal. That was a piece of slang, a real deal. Do you get that, a real deal? Okay, good. So I was starting to really sense this difference in my experience. And at the time, I was also working a lot on race relations in the United States back in the 90s. And there was a moment where I just spontaneously started to use Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of grief, that there were people talking about race who were in a state of denial that there was any problem. There were people who were really enraged and angry, and rightfully so. There were people that had carved out a way to live with it, a kind of bargaining, if you will, of sorts. There were people who were just simply brokenhearted. And then there were these amazing people that seemed to be able to move through that territory without getting attached, without being uptight. They could advocate, they could relax, they could get mad for a moment and keep moving on. They kept the goodwill. So I was really starting to see, like, wait a minute, my model's incomplete. Something's going on that I don't really understand. So, believe it or not, and this is a true story, I was introduced to Ken's work about 3 weeks after I had this thought, like, oh, I need a stage model. Yeah, it was a beautiful synchronicity. All of a sudden, boom, there was Ken's work. And within the year, I met him. I went to, with my Zen teacher, they were doing a big mind process, so I went to Denver. And that was at the end of 2003, and that's when I met Terry and Jeff and Brother David and Suzanne and lots of people at the Integral Institute. So for that period of time, I started to change. Ken was one of those people that my encounter changed my life, and not always in ways that I expected or not always in ways that I even wanted, per se. You know, I didn't. Have you ever not wanted to change? Anybody? Any non-changers in here? Yeah, it's the shadow of evolution. If you don't work with the part of you that doesn't want to change, you'll never be able to be an evolutionary. That's my view. So what happened? So at the Integral Institute, there are a tremendous number of writers, of thinkers, of researchers, of spiritual contemplatives. They're here today. Suzanne Kogreuter's in the room. Jeff Fitch is here. Terry O'Fallon, Rob McNamara, other developmental people, all the spiral dynamics people. These guys are pros. They know what they're doing. They've done the research. They've looked at the data. They've conducted these surveys and these questionnaires. They're participating in this ongoing discourse. That was never my job at Integral Institute. I was kind of what you might call the experience girl. You know, I was the one that my job was to help bring it from third into first person. And a little tiny tidbit of theory, and then my job was to drop it. You might say I would microdose you a little bit, and then bring that theory to life. So that was what I did. And as I was doing that, usually when we were working with theory or developmental stages, if you will, or levels, there were three questions that always emerged. One was, how do we communicate across levels? Another one was, how do I enact and work with this map, including developmental levels? And the third thing, how do I continue to grow, and how do I support other people in growing? So those questions emerged every time. So at the end of our time today, I want to return to those questions. But for right now, what I would love to do is to give you an experience of developmental levels. Do you want to try it out? And if you've done it before with me, my suggestion would be that you simply relate to it as a practice. You can never do the same thing twice because every moment, every experience is going to be different. And so you should just stay awake to what's actually happening in this moment and what is disclosed through being aware, being present now, as opposed to the last time you did it. Okay? Raise your hand if it makes sense. You good? Okay, great. So we're gonna find a group in a very simple two-step model. Okay? So I'm going to tell you step one, and then I'll tell you to do it. And then I'll describe step two, and then I'll tell you to do it. Okay? So down your row, if you would just count 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, and then you'll find a stranded 2 if you're the last one. Okay, so you're going to count off 1, 2, 1, 2, and you're going to find your partner. Okay? Are you ready? All right, go, everybody. You have to do it this way. Good. Do you guys know? Jeff, do you know who you are? Yeah. Go ahead. Okay, good. Good. Does everybody, do you all have a partner? Everybody? Okay. Raise your hands if you don't have a partner. Find each other. Great. Raise your hands if you don't have a partner, and you can find each other. Okay, awesome. Awesome. Okay, second stage, are you ready? Can I have a gong, please? We'll see how this works. You ready? I'll do it. All right, you ready for step two? All right, step two. This is where it gets interesting. We don't have to do it this way, but I'm trying to maintain a little order because I know how raucous you people are. It's our little military discipline. Every other row, I'll give you the directions and then I'll say go. Every other row, row one, row three, row five, row seven, row nine, row 11, all the way back, you are going to stand up. You're going to turn around, and your pair is going to find the closest two people behind you. You're going to turn your chairs around, sit down, be quiet, and then I'm going to tell you what happens next. All right, you ready to go? Ready? Okay, go. Am I using this? Instead? This? That? Raise your hand if you don't find a group, and the facilitators will help you find one. You should be in a group of four, everybody. Group of four. Group of four. Okay? Raise your hand if you don't. How many are in your group? Go ahead, Silu. Yeah. Yeah. Perfect. All right, we're getting there. We're getting there. Four is good. Five is okay. This is the most exciting part of the whole process because you get to meet other people. It's so exciting. All right, is everyone in your group of four? Okay, do you want to help back there, Nina? There's someone with their hand up. Great. Okay, great. Raise your hand if you need help if you don't have a group of four. We'll give you an assist. Everybody good? All right, awesome. All right, so can I get some instructions on the screen, please? All right, here's how it's going to work. First of all, everybody, I want you to point to the ceiling and point to who's going first in your group. Point to the ceiling, point to who's going first.
All right. Instructions? Oh, fuck. All right. Okay, everybody, here's the instructions. Are you ready? All right, now keep in mind what I said earlier. My job was to move from a third-person perspective, looking at something, to a first-person perspective, as Ken likes to say, looking as, right? Looking as it. So the kind of learning that we're doing is somewhat non-conceptual. You're going to shift your identity, and through shifting that identity, you're going to watch what arises in awareness. And as you watch what arises in awareness, you're going to just simply note it. And you're going to expand your experience of what this is by simply watching what comes up. So there's nothing you need to grasp. There's nothing you can say that is wrong. Okay? So here's the basic instruction, okay? You're going to listen for the sentence stem, which I'll give to you, and it's really simple. You're going to complete the sentence stem in one breath. The sentence stem would be like, a sentence stem is part of a sentence that you finish. So it would be like, in this moment, I feel blank, right? So in this moment, I feel excited and interested. In this moment, I feel, right? So you're going to do it in one breath. And any of you prone to giving little explanations? Anybody prone to giving speeches? No speeches. Okay, one breath. So you have to speak in the first person. So the sentence stem is going to be I, and you'll notice that you have to keep saying I. And I'm going to ask you, if you're willing, to do it in a whisper. And the reason is that if we do it in a whisper, the room won't get really, really loud, and then everybody isn't going to try to talk louder, so we'll actually be able to maintain our ability to hear. Okay? And there's no crosstalk, meaning this isn't a discussion, it's simply a go-round, all right? So as you complete the sentence stem, you might go around once, you might go around twice, you might go around three times. Just keep listening as you go around to what's disclosed, okay? And then listen for the gong and stop. We have a gong, but I don't know if it's working. Do you want to try it? No luck. Let's try this. Oh, there it is. Okay. So when that happens, that gong happens, just stop what you're doing and just turn your attention inward for a moment and just notice what was true for you. Okay? And then I'll introduce the next sentence stem. Okay? I'll introduce it. So the next person will begin with the next sentence stem. If any moment you have a problem, raise your hands. These beautiful people around the perimeter of the room will come and help you. All right, are you ready for the first sentence? Who's going first? Let me see your hands if you're going first. Okay, can I have the first sentence? Okay, really simple, everybody. Very familiar. Ask the question again. No, you keep going until you hear the gong. Just go around and around. No, you go in a sequence. So, Silu, Pete, Rebecca, real quick. We're going to model it, everybody. There's a question. Okay. So it's like this. It's really simple. All right, so let's point to each other. Who's going first? Ready? 1, 2, 3. Okay, Pete's going first. So as the egocentric self, what do you notice?
As the egocentric self, I notice that I'm thirsty and I'm a little bit, feel awkward in front of all these people.
Okay, good. As the egocentric self, what do you notice?
As the egocentric self, I notice that I am on stage.
As the egocentric self, I notice it's very warm in here.
Yes.
I feel warm.
As the egocentric self, I kind of wish I would have eaten something before this started. Okay? Got the idea? But you're just going to keep exploring this identity. What does it bring up in awareness when you identify as the egocentric self? Everybody ready? Here we go. You have about 5 minutes, okay? Go. Yeah. Raise your hands that if any moment you're confused. You'll tell me. you think you were enlightened, but that was just the gong. Okay. All right. So did you get to kind of go around and see what this identity brought up? Why don't you go ahead and take a moment? Go ahead and just close your eyes and notice your body for a minute. Notice what it feels like in your body. And just kind of recount, like, what was the quality like in the group? How did it feel? And then I'd be really curious to know from a few of you, you can open your eyes. What did you notice as the egocentric self? I'd love to hear from you. Anything interesting or pretty much everything you already expected? Yes, here's one. Yeah. Go to the second guy.
There was an evolution of feelings, actually, from, first of all, who are these people around and do I really need to talk to them now? And how do they feel about myself? Uh-huh. And at the end, I could say, well, it was fun.
It was
pleasure.
Fun.
Yeah. It was fun, yes.
Oh, good. Awesome. Okay, great. All right, somebody had their hand up here. Yeah, please. Go ahead. And Silu, maybe we'll go to the middle over here.
Great. We got bored. Bored listening to each other from the egocentric self.
I know the feeling. Good. Here's one, yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, please.
I noticed that the egocentric self has its own agenda. It's checking, it's analyzing, yep. It's judging all the time something.
That's right.
It's worrying, it's doing its thing, basically.
Well, it's really important to notice. One of the things when we shift identities that we're going to pay attention to is we're going to notice where the boundary of the identity begins and ends. So the boundary of the small self is small, right? So it's right here, and everything else is not me. It's me and everything that's not me. Okay, there's one over here. And so that is actually a relatively stressful experience. To be me and everything is not me, it's like, of course I'm checking and striving and making sure everything's working because I'm separate, right? So I'm trying to maintain that in spite of that boundary. Does that make sense? Okay, good. Next, I think you had your hand up here.
I realized that I do this not so often, so I liked it to express my egocentric self.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Good. Well, I think in what I understand about human development is that it implies transcending and including. So transcending this small identity doesn't mean abandoning it necessarily. I suppose you could for long periods of time. But in your case, it's nice to bring it forward. Great. There's healthy self-expression. There's healthy self-care. There's all kinds of health. But what is also true is that the egocentric self is small, is limited, and tends to suffer because it experiences tremendous amount of separateness. Do you guys buy that as a working proposition? Good. Let's take one more, egocentric self. Yeah, Eva, go ahead. Here comes a mic.
As the egocentric self, what I felt was that we got more and more comfortable, and at the end we even agreed to something that we would like to share together.
Well, that's because you evolved from egocentric. You got so relaxed that your perspective expanded and you became a we. So now you're a group. So go ahead and share it together. But let's notice, why do we transition? Awesome. Go ahead, Eva. Weren't you going to share something together? For the rest of us?
We actually want to go out in the nature and share a wine together.
Oh, great. Okay. I got you. I thought they were going to do like a song and dance or something for us. You know. Of course, as the egocentric self, I thought it was for me. You know? Who knew? Okay, great. Okay, well, it's very natural, right? So let's just take a minute and consider, when our perspective moves from this self-centeredness, not a bad thing, but limited, stressful, and it moves and gets a little bit bigger and moves to the group or moves to our family or moves to our church or moves to our integral culture, what is it that drives that move? Why does that happen? Go ahead and just talk among yourselves. Like, how did they just spontaneously got bigger by relaxing? Just boom, all of a sudden there was more identity. Right, so take a minute, just 2 minutes, just to discuss, why do you think that we grow and change? How does that happen? When you've been really narcissistic, why do you suddenly become aware of your family? Okay, good. Okay, is that it? Yeah. Three. So it's not always clear why we grow or why we change or why we expand our point of view. And it can happen over the course of a lifetime, or it can happen in a moment where you're thinking completely about yourself and then suddenly you wake up and you actually start listening to your partner. So there's always these moments where we expand our perspective. It may not be so important why we do, but rather that we do. That we do and that we can. Okay, so that's the thing we want to pay attention to. So the second, if you're the person who is right next to who went first, let's say to the person's left, you're going to start and we're going to expand our perspective and we're going to notice as the ethnocentric self what I notice is. So you're just putting on this lens, this identity, and just noticing what comes up when your perspective expands. Let's try it. Here we go. Thank you. Is it overkill? That gong for this room? Okay, go ahead. Okay. All right, so I just took a little stroll around, and some people had a question about, well, what exactly is ethnocentric? What do we mean by that term, right? So I'm going to ask Suzanne to define ethnocentric. Suzanne Cook-Reuter, everyone. Yeah.
The wonderful feeling that we, by belonging, we have more power than we had when we were all by ourselves in the other prior group. The wonderful feeling to see just how wonderful it is to be understood and welcomed. And to really know, we just mentioned that we're the chosen one. Mm-hmm. We know a little better of what's what than anybody else.
Right, very good. That's true. Now, in this room, it is highly possible that in your journey to world-centrism, and I'm going to ask Suzanne, would you mind just dropping in a little about what world-centrism is? Because sometimes we actually push our ethnocentric identity away, and it's not very accessible. How many of you found you had actual trouble with your ethnocentric identity? So this is really important. This is important. I'll ask you to find world-centric in just a minute, Suzanne, for us. So, so it could be your family identity. It could be your soccer team. Anybody here a football fan? Hell yes. You guys' ethnocentric identities totally on fire online, not in shadow. But, you know, some people right now, like, it's really hard when you're traveling in Europe to identify as an American, right? Because there's so much going on right now, and the Trump is in some people's minds, including mine. Like, an identity, he represents in a certain way the worst part of the American identity, right? So we're all, like, kind of sneaking around, hoping no one notices, you know? So sometimes we put that identity in shadow, and healthy development, the idea is that you have that fully online so that you feel the belonging, the joy of belonging that Suzanne is talking about, so that you feel what you have to be proud of in your people, what you have to really love about your culture, even if you've moved to include more. And even if you can see the shortcomings and the hypocrisy and the limitation, that there's still a way that you can participate in that very fundamental joy, right? So in our developmental journey, we think of it as like nested dolls, you know, where the self is there and it's joyful and it just isn't too fixed. And the family identity is there, but it's not too fixed. And the national identity is there, but it's free to come and go. And when you're enjoying sports, you know, World Cup, there it is. And then you let it go. So there's this kind of flexibility. All right, so let's just hear from you. Maybe we could take the mics to the center of the room this round, if you'd be willing. So do I have mic runners who can go to the middle? Let's go to the middle, and we'll come to the back. So as the ethnocentric self, what did you notice? Go ahead.
Well, the thing that surprised me the most was that my ethnocentric self got worried about my egocentric self.
Well, that's very compassionate. Did you comfort your egocentric self?
And I didn't come to that part.
Okay, that's still to come.
I'll take care of that right now.
Yeah. Very good. So just notice that flexibility of mind, that some part of you that's bigger can comfort some part of you that's smaller. That's starting to get kind of wild. All right, good. What else for the ethnocentric self? What did you notice as the ethnocentric self?
Yeah, so we started to apply it to the other groups, like our group of four, and we found that we looked down on some of the other groups.
Of course you did, yeah.
And it got very terrifying because one of our group expressed an interest to find out what the other groups were up to. And so we sort of felt uncomfortable about that. And then that member of the group apologized and wanted to come back in and showed some sort of it was absolutely terrifying.
Like, the whole thing was just totally terrifying. And, absolutely.
So you got a bit anxious about whether people committed to the group or not. And then we felt better again.
Yes, absolutely. So let's just notice there's so many dimensions in what you just said. So the first one is the boundary is no longer me and you or me and all of this or it. The boundary is us and them. And that, so suddenly you're highly, highly aware of this moment of belonging, of feeling comfortable and realizing everybody else is different. And then the value judgment comes in of, oh, we're not only different, we're better, right? And then like, oh, they're worse, they're probably dangerous. Now a little cyber espionage going on. And then the group from a world-centric place said, no, we can't do that. Right? We have to maintain our values. There's a certain way that some of our judicial systems are in that kind of challenge, right? Because that ethnocentric fear that we're being attacked all the time creates all kinds of needs for security and boundaries, and it can be a complete overreach. This is so important because when we find it in ourselves and we're working on peace issues or we're working with national strife issues or political, you know, there's so much political tension in the States right now. If we can't find that part of in ourselves, it's very difficult to work with others. That's one of the big takeaways from day. You've got to know that part of you that wants to do the same thing, that just feels the world's dangerous and you need to protect. Okay? Let's take a couple more as the ethnocentric self. Let's see where the mic is. There's one here and there's one there. Go ahead. What did you notice?
Okay, I noticed that we are unique, as you said. And
yes.
I also noticed to be worried so much that the other groups might have more fun than we have.
But of course they didn't have more fun than we did.
No, definitely not.
Jeez, well, as we move to world-centric, maybe they'll share. Because before we move, it's, you know, you have to go to their weddings and their funerals, and then you'll have a good time. Okay, good. Well, let's take one more, the ethnocentric self.
My ethnocentric self felt really, really cool.
Gosh,
last
you guys.
Time, I was the only one from my country. And now I've just looked around, and there are 10 of us.
Oh, fantastic.
So there's a lot of pride around Ukraine.
Ukraine.
Yeah.
All right. Good. That feels good. All right. So one thing to notice as you're identified with the ethnocentric self, that there's already this, it's like an egoic kind of identity. It gets slightly inflated, right? So it isn't just that we have a group. It's that we identify with our group. We're proud of our group. We like swell in the ranks of our groups. We start throwing our weight around a little bit. And if you are, I would just ask you, at what point in your life, if you were in a traditional family or in a church or something that you grew away from, what was it that actually caused that change? And sometimes it's the downside of the pride. You start to feel ashamed. You start to feel there's hypocrisy. You start to feel that it's too exclusive. So let's take 3 minutes and just explore. If you've ever experienced moving from a more ethnocentric identity in your life into something more world-centric, what Suzanne will explain, what happened? What happened that change happened? Let's look at that again, okay? Yeah, 3 minutes. Just to... Yeah, what caused you personally to move out of that, if you did? Okay? All right, here we go.
Ready? It's interesting. That's good. It's interesting, huh? So, one of the things that I learned, and I do think it's helpful to have when you're taking a third-person perspective. When you're in a first-person perspective, all you need to do is access your own experience. Right? The truth verification for first person is it's what you think, believe, feel in your first person. As my grandfather said, all you need is your own consent. And that's what makes it so amazing. But if you need a third person perspective, you go to somebody like Suzanne. If you need a third person perspective, go to the expert, right? Go to someone who actually knows it really well from that point of view. So I'm going to ask her a question in a minute. Was it an interesting conversation to travel or to look at how one another maybe moved from an ethnocentric culture way of being to a more world-centric? How many of you felt like you've experienced that transition in one way or another? So that you have the inside track on what that's like. And one of the things to keep in mind is that we're always posing this question of how do we help people grow, but we never pose the question of how do we help people grieve. Right? Because people who are leaving culture and differentiating, if you will, are also experiencing loss. So when you left and grew to another perspective, there was probably a lot that you let go of. So I think as we talk about growth and expansion, we have to also talk about non-attachment. We have to talk about letting go. We have to talk about supporting people who feel disoriented, who've lost their communities, who basically don't know how to belong in this moment. Because lots of times there's a period of kind of, you know, very unsettled, not knowing who I am when we're in a growth process of some kind. So, Suzanne, you want to remark on that for a moment? Getting a little backup here.
Talking about the growth process and the necessity to be aware that what we leave behind, you may initially react against it. I'm no longer this. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely no longer ethnocentric. Mm-hmm. But then one hasn't found an inner home yet.
Right.
And there's a lot of support to reintegrate that. I mean, we always talk to include, transcend, and include.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the include part is often all the way through up to the later levels, a piece that needs to be worked on.
That's right, because you had to push off or reject in order to grow. So then how do you reach back and include the healthy part? That's actually its own process.
Yes.
All right, excellent, thank you. All right, oh, one more thing, Suzanne. Is everybody ready to expand? Okay, good. Would you define world-centric for us? What is world-centric?
Let's face it, the world is in a mess.
World's big.
We are rational beings.
Yes, we are.
And we can let our differences for the moment aside because we have an important goal. And we know how to go about making the world a better place. So let's put disagreements aside and just agree for this purpose we are all joining efforts.
Fantastic. And we're no longer afraid of our differences. We're actually excited by them. We can shift identities. We can walk into a Christian church and participate in Christian prayer. We can sit in a Zen retreat like Brother David has done and practice meditation. Roger Walsh was talking to me the other day about how he has studied the Course in Miracles. He's practiced in Tibetan Buddhism. He's practiced in Zen. It's like that kind of fluidity and that lack of fear of difference is really, really strong. And that is not true for people who are mainly seeing through an ethnocentric lens. There's way more threat when they experience difference. Okay? So next question, third person starts. As the world-centric self, what I notice is. Let's see what comes into awareness this time when you shift identities. You have 5 minutes.
Thank you. egocentric self, it's not too egocentric to wear in tweed.
Am I live? Okay. You go. Yeah. Ready? I don't know why that is so fun, but that is really fun. All right. So as the world-centric self, what did you notice? And we've sent the mics to the back of the room. So if we could get some of the things that came up for you as you identified as world-centric, let's hear what they are.
I noticed the pleasure of the diversity of the meeting were possible for us.
Yeah, very good. Very good. So the pleasure in the diversity. At ethnocentric, the pleasure is in the sameness, right? It's more complex. You like the sameness, but you also like diversity at world-centric. Okay, good. What else did you notice?
We noticed that there are, as world-centric cells, we noticed that the world is facing many, many awful troubles, but
yes,
we also noticed the excitement about being in this together and being able to collectively self-reflect.
Absolutely. Very good. So you feel that tremendous expansiveness. So you're taking in the world, the diversity, the landscapes, the different cultures, different geography, and you also expand to include the problems. Right? And while those problems are overwhelming, as we were already talking about, there's a pleasure in this idea that we can drop our differences and work on them together, as Suzanne was saying. Excellent. Thank you. What else did you notice in the back of the room about being world-centric? What you noticed?
An interesting thing happened because the sentence actually says as the world-centric self. And so some of us kind of got in touch with the higher world-centric self. And that wasn't that personal anymore. So
nice. Yeah.
Some more stuff came up there.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, great. You're getting a little ahead of my process, but well done. You know, development, you can't hold it back. Go ahead. Yeah, as the world-centric self.
Yeah, we noticed in our group that we had immense joy of being together as humans, mm-hmm. but it felt like there was still some kind of an edge or boundary around
totally.
That had to do with the planet and animals. Mm-hmm. and feeling some kind of pain or worry around our impact and our connection there.
Totally. So let's just pay attention to that, and then I'm going to go to Suzanne for a comment. But keep in mind, we are doing the most crude shift in identity, right? But what we notice is that as the world-centric, suddenly other life forms are really important to us, and that didn't even come up at ethnocentric. Did you notice that? Now, that's not to say that individuals don't, but there's a way that if you're not in an indigenous culture and you've separated or differentiated from the earth, there's this moment in this world-centric where the planet itself, her ecosystems, different life forms, they all come online and are very alive for us. And one of the things I've heard Ken say over and over and that I've taken in is that it's very hard to change environmental policy in highly ethnocentric places. Because it simply doesn't arise as when you're feeding your family, you're taking, and you're really so identified that the planet, the bird, it's just not there in the mind. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, and there can be, there's some panic about that. There's some grief about that. There's a tremendous amount of fear about the long-term situation. I was going to have Suzanne add just a couple more clarifications. Do you have a mic nearby? For world-centric, yeah.
So I was only talking about the rational side of this, that what we would, many of you know as orange. But of course, world-centric includes the next level as well, where you realize that the rational is not everything, and you start recognizing your own interiority mm-hmm. and that of other people, and then it becomes interesting. You really want to know what's going on for other people mm-hmm. and how different they are and how they have come to be different than you, the different paths, the different programming we all have had, socializing, all of that. And so then you have the energy to look at all different kinds, get together with those you think will work mm-hmm. on the same thing, mm-hmm. and just enjoy also the differences. Really dig them.
Really dig them. That's some slang. So you can imagine that when we do conversations about race, that it takes some little bit of world-centric perspective to even have the conversation. But within the conversation, people drop in very powerfully to often an ethnocentric perspective. Or sometimes in my work, if there are white people with black people in the room, the white people will start identifying with the black people's experience and not want to identify with being white. So they'll give up a kind of ethnocentric identity. So in a funny way, I have to sometimes encourage everybody to be more ethnocentric and really pay attention to this world-centric, ethnocentric difference and learn how to navigate both parts of who we are. So in my work, it's really, really critical. This makes an enormous difference in what I do. And it just changes how I work with people based on this. So I'll say a little bit more about that in a few minutes. So we're going to go ahead now and move to the cosmic-centric self, but I'd like to use a little different part of your awareness to access this. So if you would be so kind, we'll do this in a little bit more of a guided meditation style. And so if you'd go ahead and sit up in your chair and close your eyes, and I'm going to facilitate you in expanding, if you will, beyond space and time. So take a moment just to bring your attention into the here and now. And simply allow whatever impressions, sensations, or experiences that arise, just simply allow them to come and go. And identify, if you would, as the cosmic-centric self. And just notice, how big are you as the cosmic centric self? Do you have a limit? Do you have a boundary? As the cosmic centric self, when were you born? When did you begin? Notice how your relationship to time changes. When will you end? Noticing this boundlessness, what are all things to you? What is the world-centric self to you? What is the ethnocentric self to you? What is the egocentric self? All these identities, these worldviews, what are they to you? And from this perspective, this vast, open, radically present perspective, what can you offer to the world-centric self? What can you offer to the ethnocentric self and to the egocentric self? What does this identity, non-identity have to offer to other parts of you? And that's the question I would like for you to discuss in your small groups. What did you see as the cosmic-centric self? What can you offer to the world-centric, to the ethnocentric, and to the egocentric part of yourself? Okay, I'll give you about 3 minutes to explore this. Go ahead. You'll have to notice who you're speaking as. 4 minutes. I'm not sure what you said in your conversations, but I would pay attention to what I just said, because I think those are special instructions to you as to how to work with your own development. I don't know, but just take a minute to see. Were you getting instructions about yourself for a minute? All right, pay attention to that. So here, would you do me a favor? Would you thank your partners for being such good listeners? Stand up, turn your chairs around, and we'll bring this in for a landing. You ready? So, can anybody, let me get my bell. Can anybody remember those questions that I mentioned in the very beginning? Remember I said that when I started working and giving people little doses of theory and bringing things to life, that inevitably there were three questions that came up? They're all questions related to how to serve, fundamentally. So questions related to how to serve. How do I communicate, help people communicate across levels? How do I enact and use these frames in a way that really makes a difference? And how do I support others and myself in the development? And I think that basically, in Zen study and practice, there's a beautiful expression that sometimes when a student poses a question, the master will say, I would love to answer it, but if I did, I'd be stealing your life. Because the question itself, I think Rilke, the famous German poet, wrote to the young poet, you have to live the questions, right? So these questions are real. And the ability to actually, in our work, in our study, we call it a koan, the ability to actually take a koan or a question or a dilemma or a puzzle and to take it very, very seriously and playfully and to live it and to inhabit it and to pretty soon allow the question itself to shape you and to come to life is really the answer to these three questions. There isn't a glib set of answers. If you genuinely wonder these things, then you genuinely are obligated to live into the answer. Does that make sense? So a couple of things that I found, I think spiritual practice is so helpful because it helps us. All practice is designed to help us dissolve identity and identify with something greater than ourselves. I think that listening and really learning how to be present, how to suspend your judgments, how to receive the true and partial perspectives of others, and then to still maintain your opinion and your position. And if you have to act politically and if you have to take a stand, that's okay, but it doesn't mean that you haven't listened, and it doesn't mean that you don't respect the partial truths, even if they're distorted or wrong. So losing identity does not weaken your work in the world. It strengthens your work in the world. I always remember this wonderful story about General Patton, you know, in Tunisia in the Second World War. How many Germans are there in the room? Okay, just an ethnocentric moment. Are you guys up for it? Just for fun? I guess there was a battle between Rommel and Patton, and Patton got the news that the American forces had actually defeated Rommel, and he said, Rommel, you son of a bitch, I read your book. It's the same as listening. You know, you enter someone else's world. Anyway, I guess that didn't go over as well as I'd hoped. Anyway, so listen, be respectful, take things in, act if you need to. Hold the question, sustain the question, and then finally, your practice should deepen your heart and clarify your trust. And the great Sufi poet Rumi is way better at expressing this than I am, so let's just see what he has to say. He says, our loving is part of infinite love, without which the world does not evolve. Forms move from inorganic to vegetation to selves endowed with spirit through the urgency of every love that wants to come to perfection. So trust yourself. Trust your love, be good to the people around you, and join me in thanking the facilitators and Steph Brown for making this beautiful thing up there. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Suzanne. Thank you so much. Suzanne.